I'm really excited and slightly anxious to announce that my book, The Autistic Burnout Workbook, is releasing this next week. It comes out March 11th. It's available for pre-order right now. I am trying to avoid falling back into burnout. When you release a book, there is a lot of pressure to do promotion and to market and to get the word out there. So this is my burnout prevention form of marketing. I'm running a special right now for those who are supporting my work through pre-ordering. You can submit that information after you pre-order, and we will get you a coupon code that you can use toward our store for the same amount. So the workbook costs $18.99. So then you'd get $18.99 to use in our digital shop or in our Etsy shop, which would get you another digital workbook for free. So you buy one workbook and then you get a digital one for free. That is the promotion I'm running. It's technically a pre-order promotion, but I've been a bit behind on getting the word out. So for listeners of the podcast, I'm going to extend that. If you buy the book in the next month, you can go ahead and redeem the special. The link for that is in the notes below. Thank you so much for supporting my work. It means so much to me, and I just really appreciate you and hope that you will find this a helpful resource for you as you continue to build a life that is a bit more resilient to autistic burnout.
Hey everyone, you are listening to another episode of the Divergent Conversations podcast. Megan and I are really thankful for all of you listening, subscribing, downloading, and sharing in 2023. We are re-releasing some of our favorite episodes because we both need a break. And we want you to be able to get all of the information that you can out of these episodes. Six of our favorites for sure. We think that if you haven't listened already, they're a great introduction to the podcast. If you have already, hopefully there's some takeaways that you come away with this time that you didn't the first time around. We will be back in 6 weeks for another round of episodes and seasons. We have some great interviews lined up. We've had some incredible people scheduled already, including Dana Abraham, Tiffany Hammond, and so many more people. So really appreciate everyone listening. Make sure to like, download, subscribe, and share on every single Friday on all major platforms and YouTube. Hey, everyone. You are listening to the Divergent Conversations podcast. We are two neurodivergent mental health professionals in a neurotypical world. I'm Patrick Cassell.
And I'm Dr. Neff.
And during these episodes, we do talk about sensitive subjects, mental health, and there are some conversations that can certainly feel a bit overwhelming. So we do just want to use that disclosure and disclaimer before jumping in. And thanks for listening. Hey, everyone. You're listening to another episode of the Divergent Conversations podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Patrick Cassell, joined today by my other co-host,
Dr. Neff.
And today we're going to talk about finding a neurodivergent affirmative therapist and how complicated that can be, questions to ask, things to avoid, resources, etc. So a really cool topic segueing off of Megan and my conversations around our own diagnosis history and stories and some of our personal pathways into kind of finding therapy for ourselves and how challenging that has been. And I think it's been a rough road, but I think we've both kind of have got that sorted out now, but I think it's taken a long time and a lot of trial and error and a lot of misdiagnosis, missed opportunities, and unfortunately, sometimes some trauma involved as well.
Yeah, that's a good summary of it. I'm curious, because I know you really like your current therapist. How did you find her? Was it like, were you specifically looking for a neurodivergent affirming therapist, or was it coincidental?
It was coincidental because when I was looking, I had not even gotten my results back from the testing that I had done yet. So
okay.
I was looking very specifically for someone who could support me with certain things like feeling like I'm never doing enough, I'm being lazy, I'm being unproductive.
All those ADHD things.
Yeah, all the ADHD things really of like, and I also wanted to finally try hard to absorb and take pride in some of my accomplishments instead of just moving to the next thing. Simultaneously was doing testing to figure out if I was autistic, if it was ADHD, if I was missing something, and got my results after I had scheduled an intake with her. So I was really actually very anxious about that first interaction because I had heard some horror stories from some friends who had recently been diagnosed as autistic. They had told their therapist and their therapist, like, kind of in the middle of conversation were just like, yeah, I don't feel competent enough to help you. And I'm
I see and hear about that a lot. Like, sorry, can't touch that.
Yep.
Refer you to a specialist. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And I think the problem, you know, is who are the specialists?
Right.
And
are they working with kids?
Yeah, they're working with kiddos. And a lot of the times they're also practicing from an ABA model.
Yeah.
And I think that just like any other marginalized group, when someone says like we're anti-racist or we are pro BLM or we are like supporters of the LGBTQ community, it's very easy to just say that and not
have the training
or the competency or the ongoing consultation. So I think it's very easy to get caught in between the like finding the person who knows a little bit about neurodiversity, but like really isn't a specialist, but like at least is open to working with people. And I think that's where a lot of people end up because we have so few resources out there, at least in my opinion, in Western North Carolina, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like, I hope this is encouraging. This probably isn't a super popular opinion, but I am less, in part probably because of my experience with my previous therapist, but I'm less convinced the person has to be a specialist in neurodiversity and way more about their attitude and their energy and their ability to be curious and their ability to be relational and ability to be interpersonal. Like if you find someone who is curious with you and will engage in the interpersonal process of like, what's happening here? Can we understand that? Can we, do we have this like psychic strength to tolerate looking at that? Then I think you're in good hands. So for me, I often, it's less about how, what trainings have they done? What do they know? And more about who they are as a human. And are they open to being curious about this with someone?
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think that, you know, for any therapeutic relationship, that's really crucial. Much more so than like trainings or certifications or letters behind someone's name.
Yeah.
And, you know, we still see a lot of therapists who say like, I specialize in ASD or I specialize in Asperger's or whatever the case may be. And you're like, well, I'm not going to refer to this person probably. Checking that one off the list. So I think you're right, though. I mean, the curiosity piece and the ability to just really be open and to even be learning as they're going. You know, a lot of therapists, well, I think all therapists should be doing continuous lifelong learning, but the ability to do so with a client who they may be unfamiliar with or they don't have as much background in working with, I think that's really important as well. And that goes a long way to kind of build that trust and rapport.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know, I think the horror stories we hear a lot of, like the, I told my therapist this and they referred me out. And I used to experience that a lot when I only worked with male identifying clients who were struggling with addiction. A lot of them would come to me and say, like, I talked about my drug usage or my you know, lack of sobriety.
That's a real common refer out.
Yep. Like middle of conversation stuff. Like, someone saying like, hey, I relapsed and I went back to using amphetamine, and then the therapist saying like, whoa, all right, this isn't for me. I'm going to refer you out. But I've always...
So shaming.
It
Can
is.
You imagine disclosing that and someone be like, oh, no, I can't handle you.
Right. And like, what do you expect to be happening in the middle of that therapeutic conversation? Like, you can't wait until the end of the session to have that conversation about referrals.
Right. Or even to take an interpersonal approach of like, I'm hearing this and I care deeply about you. And here are some of the things coming up for me around this of this isn't my background. And I'm wondering, am I the best person to support you through this, and then like to process it with the person versus just that sorry no. And I mean, talk about like an attachment injury. There's just so much about that that makes me cringe.
I thought it was mind-boggling, and I thought my, you know, this person was just, this was being embellished. Then I met the therapist, and they like confirmed everything. They're like, yeah, I said that. That's how this went. That's how I referred them to you. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, you can't just, I think therapists are so often unable to handle like healthy confrontation and feedback process in a relationship. So we avoid it. And then it's like, I'm going to cover my ass. So I think the best scenario is like, refer out.
Yeah. There's a lot of cover your ass. Which then, and that thing again, what happens to the person when they feel like a liability? I've just disclosed something really vulnerable and I'm now a liability. Like, Martin Buber is a philosopher. I'm a big fan of, and he talks about the I, thou, I, it encounter of like, I, thou is seeing the sacredness of the other. I, it is that kind of objectifying, like in that moment of, I can't handle you, I'm referring you out. Like that became an I, it moment. And in a relationship where there's supposed to be a lot of I, thou encounter, it's just, it's so wounding.
It's really wounding. And, you know, I think so often, right, if we're talking about people who are ashamed of their diagnoses or their presenting concerns, and they've been stigmatized and discriminated against, and you come into therapy, a place where like you've finally been able to pick up the phone or email and finally made this appointment, and then that is the response, the odds of you seeking out therapeutic support ever again in your life drastically reduces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is something I tell like trainees when I'm working with like psychologists in training or therapists in training, is because there's so much pressure when you're in training to like do everything perfectly. And I'll sometimes remind them, like, if they have a positive encounter with you, that is incredible, because it means that they can trust the process of therapy. They're more likely to go back when they need it. Like, make that your goal. Have a positive encounter with this other human. And it's not about like doing all the techniques perfectly or making sure their depression symptoms are all the way reduced. It's, can you have a human to humor? Human to human, authentic, meaningful encounter where they feel like this is something that they want to return to.
Absolutely. I think that's a testament to doing really wonderful work. And that's where the healing and that takes place too. And someone then becomes much more invested. And then the shamefulness and the stigmatization kind of dissipates. And it's like, okay, that wasn't so bad. Like, I can go and talk about this. And I will say, you know, you mentioned my own therapeutic experience, and that intake was very anxiety provoking for me because I had just gotten these diagnoses.
Oh my gosh.
Still processing. And I was like really excited to see this person. I've been waiting a long time. She had quite a significant wait list. And I was like, I'm just going to wait it out. And, you know, I want to see this person. And I would have really probably been pretty devastated had the response been something different. But what happened was, I was just like, listen, I want to be really transparent with you. I did just do testing for autism and ADHD. And I did come, you know, I did get or receive a diagnosis for both autism and ADHD. And I just want to name that because I'm fearful that you're going to tell me that we can't work together. And she was like, oh yeah, my son's autistic, so you're probably in a good spot. And I was like, oh, well, this feels like...
That's amazing.
Yeah, it felt like very much aligned with what I've been working towards. And a couple of good friends in town had given me her name, and I think they probably knew I was autistic. So I think they did so with like the best of intentions in terms of referrals. Yeah. So I've been really fortunate, and I know that, and I don't take that for granted at all. She actually listens to our podcast and follows your information on Instagram. So she's excited for all this stuff to come out.
Yeah.
I can't stand
it. Do you all process that as client therapy of like, and then you see this other side of me? Yeah, because that's really interesting.
I think that dual relationships. I'm okay with dual relationships.
I wonder if that's an autistic thing, because I am too. And I kept pushing my therapist and we wrapped working together, but we worked together for like 4.5 years. And I kept pushing for more dual relationships. And he held the frame of like, and I mean, he's psychoanalytic. It's a little bit more, but I think it's kind of an autistic thing, and maybe related to the whole like hierarchy of we're two humans having a really meaningful encounter. Why is it so contained? But I actually understand it therapeutically also why it's important. But sorry, I interrupted. Talk more about
that. Yeah, I think that's important to name, because I think that's true. Because now I'm thinking about all the autistic therapists that I know or that I employ who also are absolutely okay with having dual relationships in their lives. And I think it is like the recognition that, yes, this setting is for this, but like we are also humans who live in a community together, and like there's going to be overlap, and like there's going to be potential interaction in other areas of our lives. So I actually think it's great, because that's actually a good segue into what to look for in a therapist who's ND affirming, because someone who will willingly explore your special interests. That's so, so important for someone to like not just shrug it off, not just try to like deflect or to, you know, kind of transition to a different topic. But if a therapist is recognizing, like, oh, this autistic client is really into A, B, and C, like, let's just go with it and see where that goes, because that's another way to drop that guard down quite a bit.
Oh, absolutely. That's when I'm working with therapists, and they're kind of, I typically when I'm working with therapists, a lot of it's around like helping them refine their assessment skills. And a question I'll often ask is, do you feel like you contact them when they start talking about an interest? And by contact, I mean like you see them, like you feel them in the room for the first time. And when therapists are like, yes, that to me, that's a like, okay, that's a green flag that we're looking at autism here. Is you feel like you're contacting the person for the first time when they start talking about their special interests. Before that, it's you're asking all those social-based questions like, tell me about your family, tell me about your friends. And you're getting like one-word answers, or like, it just feels really, you don't feel like there's a person there, probably because most of us are in freeze state when we get asked social-based questions.
Right.
And so if you want to get access to the person, you absolutely... doing that through special interests versus those social-based questions. I think that's a huge part of autistic affirming therapy.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that makes a huge difference. It just feels more real, feels more authentic. Mm-hmm. You know, you can really drop in then, and you can see the personality start to come out too.
Yeah.
And excitability as well.
Emotion, which is good for therapy.
Right, yes.
Like I just got, did you see how my effect just like went way up when I started talking about like because talking about autism and special interest therapy
is your special interest.
Yeah.
One of your special interests.
Yeah. One of my special interests, and my energy just went way up.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's so important to follow that. And so often I think I've been in so many therapeutic relationships as the client where, you know, I am just either going to be like robotic sounding board, I rehearse answers, like know what to say, versus like the ability to dig deeper and actually go into processing trauma or lived experience, because we're connecting on the same wavelength, because you're allowing for me to diverge where my brain is going instead of trying to circle back constantly and like, so let's talk about this. It's like, no, I don't want to talk about that right now.
And that to me, like that would be a, if we're talking about kind of red flags of like ND affirming therapist versus not, I think that would be a red flag of someone who's maybe not a great fit. If every time you start talking about something you're excited about, like the therapist kind of does that with you for a couple minutes, but then circles you back to, okay, and the point of this is.
Right.
And so, but tell me about like how that makes you feel, or tell me about like trying to redirect it back
to what happens to the typical autistic person when that happens to them. Like, what is your,
what happened?
Like, what's the instinct or like the reaction typically when someone like does that?
Well, I'll share my experience. I was working with So I was working with a spiritual director, which is different than therapy, but kind of a there's a similar back and forth aspect to it. And this was back when I was I no longer identify as religious. This was back a few years. But I was explaining, so Moltmann is this theologian I love, and I was really into Moltmann, and he was helping me he's very philosophical. So he's helping me like think through a lot of my psychic stuff as well as my like relationship to the sacred. And I was getting really into Moltmann and explaining it because I was reading this like 1,000-page book at the time. And then my spiritual director was like, yes, but when you talk about that, where do you feel it in your body? Oh. And she was bringing it back to like an holistic. And I was like, I was just telling you how I felt about it by like unpacking who Moltmann is, the ideas I'm engaging with. Like, I literally was just telling you how I feel about it. But then she was bringing it back to holistic speech of emotion words, body words. So I froze in that state and I like shut down. And I think I went back to like the pre-scripted conversation. It was a requirement of a program I was in when I did it. So I think all the other sessions after that, I would come up with, this is what I'm going to say. I just kind of bared through them. I would brace for it because it felt very intrusive. Attending these visits, and I felt very inadequate of like, why are these questions hard for me to answer? I didn't know I was autistic at the time. So like, why is this so hard for me to answer? Every time I go academic, she'd try to bring me back, but that's how I disclose my inner world to people, is through ideas. And I think she saw that as a defense. And so I was trying to bringing me back into emotion language, which is a language that that's not how I share my inner world with people. I'm not like, this is how I feel about it. And that's just not my language.
Yeah.
So that's what happened to me. I froze and got defensive and scripted out how I'd make it through the rest of sessions.
Yep. And I think that also, in my opinion, creates some shamefulness internally of like, mm-hmm. at least for me, what happens is I shut down, like you just kind of mentioned, and then I started thinking like, why the fuck can't I access this? Like, why can't I speak like this or reference this? And then I get really in my head. Mm-hmm. And that's what's been nice about my current therapist, is she has said things like that before, where she's like, you know, do you want to drop in today or do you want to do this?
I'm I like that. She's getting consent.
Yeah, she always asks, and I'm always like, no, I don't want to do that. And mm-hmm. she reads my facial expressions really well. She's like, you're not here for this today, are you? I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. So can we fucking talk about what I want to talk about? Uh-huh. And, you know, sometimes that is definitely defense mechanism too. But at the same time,
totally.
The how does it make you feel, or where do you feel that in your body? Like all the typical therapeutic language, I just can't tolerate it. And it just makes me, I've already checked out then. Like I'm just going to go to that vacant state and just head nodding and short answers and.
Does it feel intrusive to you? To me, it feels so intrusive for someone to ask, like, where your body is at, or even how you're feeling.
I think it does feel intrusive. And I think it's because, and this is, again, just my perspective, is like, when you're being asked that, mm-hmm. like saying the other person doesn't really see you and doesn't really understand your inner world. Mm-hmm. And that just makes me feel like we're really not connecting. And I'm kind of going to check out. I just don't want to have the conversation anymore.
Yeah. Yes. I think the reason that I worked with my last therapist I worked with it was the first male therapist I worked with. And I think that worked well for me because like all the emotion feely stuff doesn't work for me. And a lot of, this is so gendered and binary, but I haven't been to any gender queer therapist before. But the women I worked with who were therapists were very like feely emotion, and I needed someone who was more analytic, intellectual, which I found more easily in a male therapist than I did in the female therapist that I tried. Again, there's going to be a lot of variance there. But for me, I realized working with a male therapist ended up working a lot better. And there's plenty of female therapists who are also not feely warm. But I think, okay, I'm going to stop. I'm like, feeling myself digging myself into a hole around creating gender stereotypes, and I'm going to stop trying to dig out of that. Okay, where? Oh, this is where I was going with that. 82 route trail. In our first, after the intake, in our first session we had, he didn't start with, how are you feeling? He started with, what's on your mind? And I found myself opening up, which I was not normal for me for therapy experiences. And I realized that after, I was like, that made such a difference. That simple question, what's on your mind, versus how are you today or how was your week? That felt invitational versus intrusive. And so I think that's one of the reasons we worked together well for so long was, and again, we didn't know. I didn't know I was autistic. He obviously didn't know. But yeah, I found that a much nicer way of opening the session.
Yeah, I like that. What's on your mind? I think when you ask the, like, how's it going today, or how's your week, or how are you feeling? My instinct is always to be like, good, I'm fine. You know, like nothing's wrong. And then I feel myself as we're going through a therapy session to be like, oh, this is so wrong. Like everything is happening to me right now. But it's that instant instinct to just immediately answer with a short answer and just move on to the next question. I think that, again, when we're talking about green versus red flags in therapy, is really the approach has to really be important. And so, talking about green flags, like, let's highlight the good stuff before.
Yeah, we've kind of been down on therapists today.
We're both therapists and we're both shit talking therapists.
So I know. And there's a lot of amazing therapists out there. Like, there's therapists who come and pay me like a ridiculous amount an hour to consult with me because of one client they have. And like, yes, there are therapists out there who like care so much and are doing the work. Yeah. So yeah, I was even noticing that earlier. So like, oh, I feel kind of bad. And I think on social media right now, there's, especially in autistic world, there's a lot of negative talk around therapists. Yeah. So I was even feeling that of like, gosh, I don't want to, this is all true. And I don't want to be contributing to that narrative of like all therapists are shit therapists and don't know how to work with us. Cause there's a lot that do.
Yeah, there are. I think all of these conversations are not binary and like,
yeah,
Black and white conversations, and I want to highlight both sides of the coin.
Yeah,
because there are so many bad experiences.
There are, yeah.
Whether you're autistic or not autistic, I mean, there's a lot of bad experiences, but there are a lot of wonderfully positive, transformative, empowering, affirming experiences too. And there are a lot of wonderful therapists who are doing the work, who are curious, who are learning as they go, as we all are, and who are willing to show up and have really difficult conversations, but also be as empathetic and present as possible.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So let's talk about green flags. What are some that come to your mind when you think about like how you steer people or what they should look for, whether it's looking at the, whether it's like they're doing a search on Psychology Today or they're on the therapist's webpage? What do you think they should be looking for?
I think, again, language is important. I think that I want to see what people are using in terms of identity-based language. I want to see, like I mentioned before, are we still using ASD? Are we still using the term Asperger's? Are we really committed to the ABA philosophy and intervention set? I think that I also really want to know about, I personally like to know about therapists' identities as well. So I love disclosure. Like I really value that. And I think that is really helpful for any sort of affirmative care. But I think those are some green flags that I look for.
Yeah, I love that. Someone who's taking their time to highlight this is how I'm socially positioned in the world is obviously thinking about identity in a thoughtful way. Yeah. So I think that is a significant one. Yes, agree about identity language. And this where I love that the word neurodivergent and neurodiversity is becoming more widely used, but that I do see that sometimes sprinkled on websites, but then it's like I interaction with the content or books. I've read books where they use neurodiversity, but then it's very, it feels like they've just like substituted ASD for neurodiversity, neurodivergent. So I also like, I think respond, like paying attention to the energy you feel when you're reading about a therapist's webpage. Again, I'm very interpersonal. And so I really trust like what is happening to you when you're on this person's site energetically. Absolutely. In your body. What are you feeling? But paying attention to just how you feel when you're reading about this person and interacting with what they're putting out in the world.
I want to know also like therapists' takes on self-diagnoses. I think that's...
Yeah.
You know, I think that it's definitely a pretty controversial topic in that world, but I would like to, I always want to know, what do you think about self-diagnosis?
That's a great question. Yeah.
Yeah. Just because I recognize my privilege, like I'm able to go and get testing done and, and seek out therapy that I want to seek out instead of just what's me. And, so I want to know about that. I want to know about their, you know, you were mentioning, Carissa, before, and her webpage and their resources that they have on there and all the frequently asked questions and ways that they can help guide through.
Yeah.
I want to know about thoughts on stimming during sessions and like, able to have any sort of sensory, soothing tools. How are we gonna set up, like, do we, how are we feeling about eye contact, even like in terms of virtual sessions or in-person sessions, but virtual for sure. Like my therapist always encourages me, and she'll say it like when she can tell I'm really struggling with eye contact in general, she's like, please feel free to like look around the room and like whatever you need to do, we do. I'm right here, but you don't have to look at me at all. And at first that made me feel like really uncomfortable because I'm like looking like this and like, and like I could sense the discomfort, but in reality, like she's just like, okay, it's fine. Like do whatever you need to do. And I think that helps really feel really affirming as well.
Yeah. That whole, like, are the neurotypical scripts kind of being followed in a way where it's assumed like, okay, this is how we do it. We sit down, we look at each other. We talk. Yeah, absolutely. So I, for the last 2 years since COVID started, I've been doing phone therapy with my therapist, and I'll go out and walk. And I found I really liked that because I could get into my emotions a little bit easier if I was walking. And I would say about half the people I work with do phone therapy, and a lot of them walk during it because there's something that's regulating about walking. There's none of the eye contact. So I think even asking about like, what's your frame of therapy? And I realize it's really different around the world. In Oregon, we're still, all medical providers are wearing masks, and mask therapy is just so hard. Important for health reasons and so hard for therapeutic reasons, that a lot of therapists in Oregon are still doing teletherapy. I don't know if it's what it's like there.
I'd say the Southeast stopped caring a long time ago.
True. But
thankfully, Asheville
did they ever care?
A bit more progressive than most of the Southeast, but we are doing a hybrid mix. Our practice is predominantly telehealth. So like telehealth for the most part. I've always done telehealth therapy with my therapist. I've never met her in person. And she'll encourage that too. Like if she can tell that I'm starting to get dysregulated, she's like, get up and walk around your kitchen or like, you know, go walk around the house and come back or do what you need to do to regulate yourself. And I really appreciate the permission to do that instead of feeling like shameful about it or like, are you going to tell me to sit down or that I'm being distracting or like any of the things that I've heard throughout most of my life.
Yeah. And that, I think that can be really healing in a therapy is when the therapist is helping you like think through, what do you actually need in this moment?
Yeah.
Especially for maskers, we're so used to suppressing our needs in any given moment that A, it's hard for us to access what we actually need, let alone to do that in front of another human. So I think therapy can be a really powerful practice ground of, okay, I'm with another human. I have some sort of sensory or regulation needed in this moment. Can I practice A, checking in, figuring out what the hell it is I need, and B, actually doing that in front of another human?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's like the epitome of safety. Mm-hmm. Is if you can feel comfortable enough to unmask, mm-hmm. and really have someone else also acknowledge and see what and understand what you need in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. without that shame or that quick desire to like immediately flip that switch and be like, no, everything's fine. Like I'm okay. Because we do that so often in our day to day where we have to act or present a certain way or show up a certain way. And I think therapy can be a really beautiful place to just kind of just let that shit go and just like really show your true self. And mm-hmm. That is just so hard to do on a consistent basis.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially when you're autistic and have been actively working to not show your true self for years and years. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so deeply rooted, right?
Okay.
Sorry. I'm just.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's deeply rooted. And, you know, I think having an ND affirming therapist, that's another part of it. That's another green flag, is the acknowledgement of how much energy goes into masking. How challenging it is to really reveal like what's actually happening beneath the surface. And
yeah.
So I really appreciate that perspective and that ability as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So we've talked a bit about like language and characteristics of the therapist. I'm curious, I get this question a lot and I've got a few thoughts, but I'm going to put you on the hot seat first. Do you think there's certain therapy modalities that work better for autistic people?
Yeah, I do. I will say what I think doesn't work, but this is, again, I'm always going to defer to you when we're talking anything clinical, because that's your jam. I will always admit that I have not done the research and the work that you have done. And I think for myself and for a lot of autistic folks, EMDR, brain spotting, that stuff is really challenging. And I also think CBT is also really, really hard. The concrete, like regimented, this is what you do, this is what you do, this is what you do. I think DBT can be supportive. I love IFS. I love parts work.
Yeah.
I think that same. Is so fucking powerful. And you can really tap into those special interests with parts work. Mm-hmm. I had such a hard time accessing it, like visually, if you were like, imagine this boardroom and your parts are there and they're like communicating. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what? No, like that does not work. But my therapist knows I love Lord of the Rings. So she's like, all right. So imagine we're at that scene in the Fellowship
of the Ring. That's amazing.
Where everybody is coming together and you got the dwarves and the elves and the wizards and the hobbits. And who's doing what? And I'm like, at first I felt so fucking nerdy. And I was like, oh, this is making me so uncomfortable. But I've really been able to access so many different things when you can drop into that world and to be able to use your special interests in a way where you can feel more connected to emotions that are happening beneath the surface. I think that has been unbelievably life-changing for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I cannot agree more. I love IFS. I love it for autistic people. I will say, I don't know if you're seeing this out on the East Coast. Have you heard of Plural Systems?
Mm-mm.
It's kind of, oh gosh, why did I say that? Now I have to try and explain it. So it's, I would say it's on the DID spectrum, dissociative identity spectrum. When in learning about plural systems, what I find is a lot of people who identify as having a plural system, they have more conscious contact with the parts, but it's different than parts work. So that's the one thing with IFS. I'm like, I love IFS. But then if someone comes in and they're experiencing, like they're identifying as a we. So people with plural systems often will identify as being plural. And again, it from a affirming lens of like, this isn't something I'm trying to fix about myself. I'm trying to figure out how to integrate these parts. But that's the one thing. That I think can lead to some confusion is when you're doing IFS work, but if you're working with a plural system, what the therapist might be conceptualizing and what the person's bringing in, there's going to be a little bit more to navigate there. And there are, I've seen some CEs come out for working with plural systems. It's so new, and it's nothing that's in the DSM yet. Okay, that was a, I'm like rabbit trailing today. Told you,
Megan and her clinical work, that's right up their alley. So thank you for that.
But yeah, I'm curious what you said about EMDR. I've wondered about that. I've heard some autistic people talk about that being helpful. But it makes sense to me because it's such an isolated memory you're working with, and our brains are so divergent. So that actually intuitively makes sense to me.
Almost flooding happens too with EMDR.
Yeah.
There's a lot of flooding, and when you're bringing back that very specific memory. And I've always found that, and this is just anecdotal. So this is really not evidence or research based whatsoever. But what I've heard so often is that it's just so hard with the eye movement and constantly like flooding yourself with memory and then being able to access. And I think that for myself, I shut down immediately. I've tried it a couple of times. But I've also heard about ND affirming EMDR starting to come to the surface too. But I have not participated in it. I kind of got turned off early on in my
life. I've never tried it. I'd be curious. I think I probably would not like the flooding aspect of it. It's so experiential. I think that would be hard for me.
That's the hard part, I think, is the experience piece. And that's what was hard for me about brain spotting too. I don't know if you've done that, but like
I haven't.
I did the brain spotting training and I could not access, like, you know, you're doing the practicums and they're moving, you know, the thing back and forth, find the brain spot. Okay. And then like, what are you experiencing? What are you accessing? And I'm just like numb, flat, dissociated, nothing. Uh-huh. And when that happens to me in therapy, I get so frustrated with myself.
Oh, totally. I mean, that just you hearing that, it makes me think of all the times someone's asked me how I'm feeling and I can't answer. Like, and all of the situations I've been in where like I'm in a situation and someone's trying to evoke an emotion, especially growing up religious, I was in that situation a lot. But then also in therapy training and being like, I feel like I'm supposed to be feeling something right now and I'm not. And then I get in my head about that. So if that was
up, I was like, I want to get through this practicum. You're like, I'm feeling this thing. And like, can we fucking move on? This is awful. Yeah.
Totally. Totally.
What about you? Like, what do you think works and what doesn't? So you feel like IFS is probably up there.
Yeah. I really like IFS for especially, and I think for multiply neurodivergent people, like I'll talk a lot about like my ADHD part and my autistic part. And so I love the language of it. I think it destigmatizes and deshames because it creates a little bit of distance from parts. So like this part of me wants this, this part of me wants this. So also the ability to bring in more complex thinking, which is harder for a lot of us. We are more prone to that rigid thinking. So I think it provides a concrete way and a visual way, which works really well for the autistic brain, to do some complex, nuanced thinking. So yeah, I love IFS. Other ones, I do like ACT for a lot of autistic people. Not for everyone, but a lot of people. I responded well to like learning ACT as a therapist, and I use a lot of that sort of mindfulness in my day. It's different than CBT in that you're not trying to change the thoughts, you're changing your relationship to the thoughts. So I think it honors the complexity and the existential aspect of a lot of our thoughts while helping you to distance from them enough that you can kind of hold on to yourself and ground yourself.
Yeah.
So that's what I typically also think can work well. And then I really like interpersonal stuff because we're so often trying to figure out what the other person's thinking. That if you can do that in the room therapeutically, I think it can be really healing. It takes quite a bit of like ego strength or psychic strength to be able to do that. So maybe doing some other work before you do that. But interpersonal therapy or I really like relational psychoanalysis. Traditional psychoanalysis, I'm not sure how I feel about that for autistic people. It might be too much of a blank slate of the therapist. Relational psychoanalysis is the third wave. And it's the assumption is the therapist and you are always co-creating the reality. and that the therapist is not off the hook. They are part of the dynamic as well, but we get to talk about it. We get to understand it. We get to look at it together with curiosity. I think that sort of living lab of relationship, can we understand what's happening between the two of us, can be so, so healing, because so many of us have relational trauma and confusion coming into therapy. So I would say those four, relational, interpersonal, ACT, and IFS would be, and DBT I think has some good strategies as well, but those would probably be my favorite ones for us.
I like the relational analysis. I've actually never heard of that third wave, so that's pretty cool. I couldn't deal with the blank slate psychoanalysis. Like, mm-mm, that would be really challenging for me to be like, what is happening right now?
Yeah. I don't think it would cultivate enough psychological safety in the room to be able to do work, because partly as a high masker, we're always trying to tune to the other to figure out what does that person want me to be?
Right.
So with the blank slate, it's like we're flailing. No, but if you could talk about it, though, so like my therapist who was relational psychoanalytic, he did hold kind of a blank slate in the beginning because he could tell how badly I was trying to figure out who he was so I could figure out who to be. But we were able to talk about it. We were able to talk about what was happening around my like desire to please him or my desire to adapt to like, be the ideal patient. So I think if the blank slate is there, but it can be talked about, I think it's okay. But if it can't be talked about, if it's like, oh, well, what is it bringing up for you that you can't read me? And if it's always deflecting back to.
Yeah, that would surely ensure that I would never come back to that person. I'd be like, yep, all right.
Yeah.
Once I'm done today in 43 minutes, I'm getting the hell out of here and I'm not coming back.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on CBT for autistic folks?
I agree with you. I think it's so linear and logical, and our brains tend to be so divergent in context, like high context, in the sense that, well, that thought in this context made sense, but it's pulling thoughts out of context to work with them, which just doesn't work for most of us. It does work for some, though. And I think, like, I've worked with some people who are autistic and not autistic ADHD, who are maybe like engineers or coming from a really linear, logical background, who actually really like it. So I wouldn't do a blanket slate statement of it's always bad. I do think in general, it doesn't work well. That said, there's some things I pull from CBT, like having a list of common cognitive distortions and just being able to identify like, oh, my brain's doing that right now. Not I'm going to go in and try to change my thought, but like I'm just mindfully noticing my all or nothing thinking filters on right now. I think that sort of thing can actually be really helpful. But again, that's taking a CBT idea and then using it mindfully versus let's try and change your thought you're having right now, which I just think is really invalidating for a lot of us.
I'm glad that you named that about the folks who are maybe autistic, but not autistic ADHD, mm-hmm. How if you do find yourself in like engineering or software design or something that is really cognitive heavy, where your brain is just thinking very, very, very rigidly and linearly,
mm-hmm.
and picking out these patterns. I think CBT probably makes a lot of sense in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really glad you named that. Certainly does not work for me.
Me thought either. Stopping
in general, like thought stopping to me is fucking mind boggling. Like just stop having this thought. It's like, that is infuriating to me, but I agree. Like if you can pick out pieces of all of these theories and modalities, I think they can all be applicable and mm-hmm. useful. And mm-hmm. again, just want to reiterate to everyone listening that none of this is blanket statement stuff. Like there's always going to be little pieces that work for you. And you may have had great experiences with some of this stuff, and you may have had horrible experiences with some of this stuff. Ultimately, I think it circles back to what you named initially. And it is the rapport with therapists. Like if the rapport is there, you're going to be more willing probably to try new techniques, and mm-hmm. you're probably going to be more open to them. If the rapport is not there, you're going to shut it down. And I certainly have done that. Like if you could, that person could be the best therapist in the world, but if the connection and the rapport and the relationship is non-existent, whatever you're trying to get me to do, or try to do, I am going to not be open-minded to it. I'm probably just going to be like, yeah, I'll try it. And again, in my head, I'm never coming back here and I'm done with this. So.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I can't remember where I read this or heard it said, but someone talked about how like there's more diversity within autism than like autistic to holistic. I'm not quite capturing what they were saying, but essentially the idea that like autistic people, there's so much diversity that, and that's partly why someone's like, what's the best therapy for autistic people? It's like, well, there's a lot of different kinds of autistic people, and what works well for one autistic person might not work well for another. So I love how you said that of it. It really depends on the person and their context, and comes back to that human relationship. Is this someone that that you can have an authentic encounter with?
Yeah. And I think for a lot of you listening, and myself included, and I imagine for you, Megan, like you're going to have multiple therapists throughout your life. Probably, yeah. You know, you're going to go through these phases and chapters of healing and learning and growth and transformation and what you preferred and liked and enjoyed in the therapy room 5 years ago is probably very different than today. And the next therapist that you see will probably be very different than the one you're seeing right now. It just happens. And that's really common to have different phases of your mental health journey. So, you know, if you're feeling any sort of way about that, I just want to really validate that you're going to have a lot of people in your life who are probably going to come in and out, and some that are going to stay longer than others.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
should we do our awkward goodbye?
Well,
I can feel the energy of we're wrapping up.
No, I'm like trying to think about something real. Like we've covered a lot of ground, but like, have we talked about what not to look for? Like things for people to really pay attention to and kind of acknowledging this is probably not going to be a good fit. I guess it could be everything that is opposite of what we've talked about and what you should look for. Which seems pretty easy to state that.
Yeah.
But just my thought right now is, for those of you who are concerned about or confused about or overwhelmed with the process of finding a therapist, there are ND affirming directories out there too.
Yeah. I've got several. We can put them in the show notes, but I've got several on my resource page on my website. So if you go to neurodivergentinsights.com, I think /resources, and scroll to the middle, I've got like 4 or 5 directories. There's even one for the UK, which is awesome.
That's awesome.
And they're growing, like they're growing daily. And more and more therapists who are neurodivergent are coming out as neurodivergent. So like also it's more, I mean, pretty much every neurodivergent therapist I know has a long wait list, but there's more of us and it's easier to find us.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that for those of you listening, Megan's website has so many great resources, and that can be a really helpful way to do that. And if you're not in urgent crisis, you know, if you find someone who you really want to work with and they have a wait list,
get
on it. You know, you never know how quickly that's going to move. And it is worth the wait if you are waiting for someone specifically who really gets it or who really can help you or support you through your journey and validate and affirm, because otherwise you're scrolling through Psychology Today and you don't know who the fuck you're calling most of the time. I mean, it's just like, I'm going to call the first 20 people I see, and then whoever calls me back first is going to be my therapist. That doesn't always lead to great results for the therapist or for the client.
Yeah. And one thing I think, I think autistic people might, I know I would be this way of like, it would feel wrong to be on multiple wait lists because it's a wait list. I don't know. Maybe you're not like that. But so I like to explicitly tell autistic people, you can be on multiple wait lists. That's actually really normal and you should be on multiple wait lists. So if there's a few therapists that you're thinking they might be a good fit for me, it's totally normal to be on multiple wait lists. That it's part of why wait lists can go faster, because by the time we call someone on the wait list, maybe they've already found a therapist. Often is the case.
And you're not going to hurt the therapist's feelings by being on multiple wait lists, deciding to go with whoever comes available first. That is absolutely okay. And it's totally normal. It happens all the time. The therapist is not going to get their feelings hurt by that, they're just going to move on to the next person on the wait list. Okay. So I know a lot of the times we can feel some guilt around stuff like that, but totally part of the process.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Well, I hope this was helpful for everyone, and we will continue to have conversations around this because I think this is a very important topic for those of you who are looking for support. And again, lots of resources out there, and we'll put those in the show notes so you have easy access to them. And we will plan on seeing you next week. So we have new episodes coming out all the time on all major platforms, and we will see you later. Bye.